The topic of our class today is extraordinary cognitive achievements. We're going to look at examples of groups of individuals who have done remarkable things. This is something that's been a long time personal hobby of mine, to look at such individuals, and over the last 15 or so years I've done some more systematic studies of extraordinary individuals. It's interesting from the point of view of psychology that typically psychologists look at ordinary people and then they try to extrapolate to people who are either extraordinary in a positive sense or people who are have some kind of a deficit. So it's a rather different strategy to actually try to understand the extraordinary people on their own terms and then to worry about how they relate or don't relate to the rest of us. And so I hope you'll find this somewhat off the norm kind of lecture in terms of how we approach things and also perhaps in terms of its personal interest. I wanted to start by distinguishing among different forms of excellence or extraordinariness. Usually psychologists simply talk in terms of who is the most intelligent, who has the highest IQ, or some other kind of putative measure of intelligence. As you know, I'm more sympathetic to the notion of there being people who are extraordinary in different forms of intelligence. And that can take the form either of prodigiousness, meaning that you find in a younger person the kinds of abilities which you would usually expect to be only in an adult. So a math prodigy is a child who does math the way an adult expert would do. And individuals with high intelligence or degrees of intelligence we can reasonably expect to become experts. The most famous study of high intelligence was done by a psychologist named Lewis Terman early in the century. He studied about 1,500 individuals who had very high IQs. And the interesting thing about these individuals, whom he followed all the way to their graves, most of them are dead now, those that are alive are called termites because of the Terman study, became very successful individuals in areas like law or medicine or banking. But curiously, none of them did anything that was highly creative. So they were excellent experts, but they were not people who would ever bake the encyclopedia. In fact, two people who were missed by Terman were William Shockley, who won the Nobel Prize for inventing the transistor and also had a more notorious life as a eugenicist, and Richard Nixon, who, whether you like him or not, was certainly a very extraordinary person. The last four items on this list denote extraordinariness in ways which would comport with common sense. People are highly creative who make innovative breakthroughs in one or another domain. Individuals who are leaders, who change the position or the status or the actions of a country or a large company or some kind of an institution like a foundation or university. Individuals who are moral exemplars, people whom we admire, religious leaders, Mother Teresa's Buddha, Martin Luther King Jr. And then I like to save the word genius, which is often bandied about, for a special category, and those are individuals who discover some kind of a new and permanent truth about the world. That right away would suggest that we think about geniuses principally as being scholars, people in science or math who discover new laws about the universe or new laws about mathematics. But I also think it's appropriate to talk about artists as geniuses when they discover a new part of the world of emotions or the world of experience and capture that in symbolic form like music or painting or literature. And there are probably geniuses in politics as well, geniuses as military leaders, but I like to use the word for somebody who really expands our notion of the possible. What does genius look like? Well, here's one well-known icon. What's interesting about this icon is this is the way that we recognize Albert Einstein. But at the time of this photo, he was probably 70 and had long since passed being a genius. Basically, if Einstein had died at age 40, scientific history would be no different than when he died at age 75, because his scientific work was all done when he was a relatively young person. He went on to do interesting work in the area of politics and philosophy, but nobody would call him a genius in those spheres. The organizing principle for the talk today is to look at four different kinds of excellence, at four different kinds of extraordinariness, and focusing on those individuals who are creative. And I will define creativity at greater length, but for present purposes, creative people are individuals who introduce some kind of a new idea in practice, which eventually catches on. And it's not that easy to do. A lot more of us try to be creative than succeed. And by and large, in the literature of creativity, in psychology, all kinds of creativity have been lumped together. It won't surprise you to know that I think that's a mistake. And so, for the purpose of the lecture today, I'm going to look at least four kinds of creativity. The kind of creativity which we would associate with a university or a research setting, the creativity of a scientist or scholar, historian, philosopher, English critic, and so on. The kind of creativity we'd associate with an artist, somebody who does breakthrough work in drama or dance or poetry. Creativity connected to a political leader, somebody who opens up new options, new moves, new world thinking in the area of politics. And then a related but different kind of creativity, individuals who are innovative in the moral sphere, individuals who influence others or who themselves exemplify ways of being moral, ethical, which eventually catch on. You'll see examples of that soon. So that's the organizing principle for the rest of the talk, though at certain points I will lump various kinds of creators together. Scientists. When possible, I've coupled the pictures of scientists when they were young people and when they were actually doing their creative work. So you might have guessed this is young Einstein, as I think the movie has it, and this is another version of, you might say, Albert versus Einstein. This is Einstein. The previous slide was Albert. And obviously, this is an example of a creative scientist, somebody who, in the analysis I put forth, is highly creative in the logical mathematical area. This is another creative scientist, probably the most creative of the 19th century, Darwin, a different kind of scientist, a biologist, and in my terms, one who displayed extraordinary naturalist intelligence. This is yet another kind of scientist cum scholar. This is Sigmund, and that's Freud. And of course, his creativity was an area of psychology, psychoanalysis, clinical treatment, as well as theory of human relations. Some artists. And I should have sort of said that I consider Freud to be outstanding in the area of personal intelligences, understanding other people, understanding yourself. This is a person, an artist, outstanding in the area of spatial intelligence. This is Pablo on the streets of Montmartre, and this is Picasso. Here's an example of an artist, a very musically intelligent. And this is a picture of Igor in Russia, and this is a picture of Stravinsky. Yet another example of an artist. This is a literary artist, linguistic intelligence. This is actually his graduating picture from Harvard, class of 1910. This is Tom Eliot, who of course became rather grim-faced, T.S. Eliot, by that time an Anglican Catholic. Yet another example of an artistic creator, this one in the area of dance, Martha Graham, the essentially the founder of modern dance in the United States early in the 20th century. Yet another example for music. This is not a photograph because there weren't any photographs, just paintings of Wolfgang and of Mozart. Yet another example of an artist whom I study, a literary artist, keeps getting rediscovered and newly famous. This is Virginia Stephen, as she was called, and of course she became Virginia Woolf. Example of political leaders who were innovative, creative, for good or for ill. This is a very famous photograph of the Tehran conference, which took place in the late fall of 1943, when it was clear the Second World War would be won by the Allies, and from left to right, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill had to decide what was going to happen to Eastern Europe and other spots in controversy. And the point about being a leader or a scientist or an artist is you have a certain set of skills and abilities. You don't necessarily use them in ways which we would like. Most of us would like Roosevelt and Churchill. We probably wouldn't like Stalin or Molotov, who was standing behind him, but these were also very creative leaders, just used their creativity in ways which we would not esteem. A contemporary leader, Margaret Thatcher, one whom I've studied at considerable length, many people both in the United States and in England don't admire her politics, but she was one of the truly effective leaders of the latter part of the 20th century. And a few moral exemplars, people particularly who exercise their moral creativity leadership beyond national boundaries. I always say that my children think this is Ben Kingsley, but it's actually Mohandas or Mahatma Gandhi. That's probably a more famous picture of him. And I certainly think Gandhi is one of the incredible moral exemplars of recent times. This person is not well known, but actually a person of enormous influence in the 20th century, but more of what I call an indirect leader, someone who worked behind the scenes. His name is Jean Monnet, and that still may not help you, so I'll tell you that Jean Monnet was the French economist and statesman who, after the First World War, back in 1918, said, you know, European countries have been fighting with each other for 1,000 years. It would be nice if instead they sort of joined together and became a single union. And the Second World War came, which was even worse than the First World War. But Monet had been working on this steadily for 30 years, and he spent the next 30 years after the Second World War continuing to work in European Union. And as you know, it's finally happening. The common market, the euro, the European Union, these are more the legacy of Jean Monnet than of any other single individual, even though he's not well known. In fact, when Pamela Harriman was nominated to be ambassador to France in the Clinton administration, then Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Jesse Helms tried to block the appointment. And people wondered why he was trying to block this appointment as ambassador to France. And it turned out that Pamela Harriman had listed in her vita that she was part of the Monet Society. Now, Helms didn't like the idea of Europe bonding together, so he held that against Pamela Harriman. In fact, however, she was part of the Claude Monet Society, which was a painting society. But since the Helms staff didn't know the difference between M-O-N-E-T and M-O-N-N-E-T, that confusion was made. But this is Jean Monnet. And one other example of a moral leader, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., whose influence was primarily in the American South, but over the years has spread elsewhere. So those are examples of individuals who represent high degrees of extraordinariness and creativity in the area of morality, political leadership, various art forms, or science and scholarship. When I use the word creativity, and we're moving toward a definition now, I want to call to your attention that creativity is used very loosely on the streets and indeed in the academy as well, and we have to be able to distinguish among at least three common uses. One is anything in the arts. Some people say, oh, somebody's a little child is drawing, he or she's creative. And so we simply use the word for anything in the arts. It could be music, literary, good or bad, or otherwise. And so anything in the arts is sometimes called creative. To me, that doesn't make any sense, though, because that would suggest you couldn't be creative in other spheres, like business or law or medicine, and that's clearly wrong. A second use is to use creative for anything that kids do, anything that's playful, exploratory, whether it's in the arts or whether it's in the sciences or whether it's role play, say, oh, it's a kid, therefore it's creative. And of course, you know, it may strike us as being cute, but if we call everything that children do creative, it doesn't have much meaning. What I'm interested in is what we call big C creativity. Big C creativity is creativity which anybody who's relatively fair-minded would say that's really important work. It can be the arts, science, law, medicine, whatever. And it isn't just stuff that kids do that's cute. It's stuff that really is innovative and changes the way other people think. Clearly, there aren't a lot of big C creators. It's a very rare appellation. But it's consistent with the argument I made initially that if we want to really study creativity, we ought to study examples which are unambiguous rather than hoping that anything that kids do, anything that's in the arts, or anything we happen to like today is creative. Here's a definition which I worked out in conjunction with David Feldman and Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. And let me unpack the definition. The first thing about creative individuals, and this definition is about individuals, though we're going to move to the systems level very soon, creative individuals are creative regularly. People are not creative once in their life. That would be very unusual. Probably only creative once in their life if they die when they're young. But by and large, it's a way of being. Creative people, in a sense, approach the world differently from the rest of us. And what do they do regularly? They solve problems. Problems which either they or somebody else has dictated to them. They make things, works of art, works of science, staging plays, waging military campaigns. And they pose issues. They raise new questions. Most of us think that it's harder to come up with new questions than it is to come up with answers. That the real brilliance of creativity of an Einstein is to say, what would it be like to ride in a light beam? Could you do that? Could you go faster than a light beam? Or underlying, that's the special theory of relativity, underlying the general theory, if you were in an elevator in free fall and you were dropping all sorts of things, what would reach the ground first, or wouldn't it reach the ground at all? Raising those questions is hard. I'm not going to say that coming up with the answers is so easy, but once you've raised the question, the whole world can try to answer it. But if the question hasn't been posed, then that possibility isn't open. Very, very important part of my definition is people are creative or not creative in a domain. This is a direct challenge to the notion that somebody is creative in general and they could do art, science, politics, morality, and so on. Probably the greatest creative genius in history was Leonardo da Vinci. And there's no question that Leonardo did stuff in art and science and invention. He was creative in a number of different realms. But he's very unusual. And even he was not a creative leader. He wasn't creative in morality. And you know, he worked in certain kinds of sciences, but not others. So even he had some domain limitation, but he's a very bad example because he's unique. Most people are creative or not creative in music or mathematics or medicine or theater or philanthropy, but they're not creative across the board. The final part of the definition is one which is not particularly controversial, except perhaps for the last clause. Almost everybody agrees that stuff that is creative is initially novel. People say, gee, that's unusual, and often we reject it because it's unusual. But if it was just unusual, if I were to give the rest of this lecture hopping like this, it would be unusual, but it would not be creative unless people in the future began to hop whenever they gave lectures for some reason, in which case I would get a certain degree of credit to having been the first one. But ultimately, if it's not accepted, it's not creative. But when I say a cultural setting, a lot of stuff might be accepted for a certain period of time in a certain place, but then rejected. Or never accepted elsewhere. And that's limited compared to my definition of genius, where a kind of a permanent truth, intellectual or emotional or spiritual, is found, and eventually, because it's a permanent truth, it will be appreciated everywhere. Again, often when people use the word creative, they use it for just one kind of activity or thought, and my analysis reveals that people can do different kinds of creative activities. They tend to differ from one intelligence to another, from one domain or discipline to another. But if you want to understand creativity, you have to keep in mind that people can be creative in different ways. They can solve a problem, for example, the nature of Brownian motion, the odd kind of fluctuations that you find in physical matter. Why do they occur? That's actually what Einstein began to work on before the theory of relativity, or you know, a piece of music has been written for piano and you reorchestrate it for an orchestra, that would be solving a particular problem. You can develop a general conceptual scheme that's much admired around the university and indeed in this course. And that would be a theory of the unconscious like Freud, or a special theory of relativity a la Einstein, or the theory of evolution a la Darwin, or Chomsky's theory of syntax, or Piaget's theory of intellectual development. That's prized at the university, perhaps more than solving a particular problem. Then there's creating a permanent work. That's essentially what artists do. Things like poems, paintings, symphonies exist, and artists say to themselves, in effect, well, I'm going to write a poem. And, of course, that doesn't mean the poem's going to be any good. The poem will change. Sometimes poems are occasioned by requests to, you know, honor somebody who's being crowned or who died or something like that. But the key thing is there that you're adding to an already existed genre. And then there are two kinds of performances which I think also can be creative. One is what I call a stylized performance, where the creativity is in the moment of the performance, but the performance is pretty well programmed ahead of time. I don't consider what I'm doing now to be at all creative, but it is a stylized performance. I essentially have a script on this PowerPoint, and I'm just elaborating a list, so there's not going to be any great surprises unless the earth begins to shake. That's a stylized performance. But there also are high-stake performances. A military campaign at a somewhat more mundane level, a political debate for the presidency, or Satyagraha, which was Gandhi's innovation of a peaceful kind of resistance, a civil disobedience. And those are very high stake. People can die. Nobody dies in a live dance or stage acting, again, unless it's a fluke. So particularly if you're in education and you're thinking about children and you want to use the word creative, one, you ought to be sparing, because probably most of the stuff that kids do isn't particularly creative. But you might be looking for early intimations of that. And it isn't good just to look at whether they do their math problems well. You need to know, are they do some of them think broadly and synthetically? Are some of them very creative? And we actually once did a study of how kids write book reports. That's a genre which is very entrenched in fifth grade, but you can write more or less creative book reports. Stylized performances or high-stake performances. Debate would be a high-stake performance, or a football game at the secondary school level, though it's not that high-stake a performance in the larger sphere. Now, my colleague, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who's been working on creativity for 40 years, it was his early work with Jacob Getzels, which called attention to one of the most important findings in creativity, namely that if you look at artists who are in training, and you want to predict which ones are going to be judged creative, and you give them a task such as drawing a still life, which you place a bunch of objects in front of the budding artist, those who just sit there and who draw what they see end up being judged much less creative than those who sit there for quite a while thinking about things, then rearrange the objects, maybe add some, take some, put them in new arrays, and render that set of objects instead. And so they came up with this very interesting notion that a criterion for a future creator or for a present creator is problem finding, that is coming up with something new rather than just taking the problem as given. But about 20 years ago, Mihai began to develop a powerful view, which we call the systems view. Howard Gruber also uses the term systems, but not exactly in the same sense. And the notion of the systems view is you have to think of creativity as an interaction between what I call three different nodes. And the move that Csikszentmihalyi made was to stop asking who is creative or what is creative, and instead use the locution where is creativity, and arguing that the creativity inheres in the relationship between the bottom right of the triangle, the individual talent, the domains in which the talented person works, that's roughly speaking the disciplines or crafts or arts which already exist in the society, and then the fields. And the fields is a sociological concept. It is the gatekeepers, the individuals and institutions that make judgments of quality. So let's make this concrete. Let's assume that everybody in a class of 50 is a young budding artist in New York City. These are the individual talents, and they all want to be acclaimed painters. So they're instructed by the domain. The domain means the already crystallized knowledge of how you paint. They might go to a conservatory or an academy or some kind of an art school where they learn the moves, so to speak. They may also go to the museum, because the museum is a repository of past knowledge, and many future artists will copy, you know, a Durer or a Picasso as a way of learning. So the domains instruct the individual talents. The individual talents then begin to produce works on their own paintings, drawings, sculpture, whatever genre, medium they use, and they address the field. And the field are the critics, the gallery owners, the people who would give prizes, the people who admit you to graduate school or give you prestigious prizes. And the field is very, very powerful, because the field ignores you, the chances you're ever going to be judged to be creative are nil. Among the people who are picked out by the field as having a certain degree of talent or creativity, very few will actually refashion the domain. To pick the two most famous icons of the 20th century, Picasso and Pollock, painting was different after Picasso, was different after Pollock. They changed the domain, so the next generation that's studying art has to learn the lessons of Picasso and Pollock and Matisse and Warhol, and not only the lessons of Rembrandt or Velázquez or Manet or earlier kinds of artists. Now you might say, well, that's painting, and of course, you know, anything goes in painting. What about a much more vertical domain, as we call it, like mathematics? Well, we argue that exactly the same thing happens in mathematics. You've got a bunch of individual talents, young mathematicians, the math types, and they're instructed by the domain in a quite formal way. They learn, you know, algebra and trigonometry and calculus and number theory and topology, etc. And then they address the field. These are the graduate advisors and the assistant professorships. And a very few of them get picked out. By a wonderful coincidence, the best mathematician under the age 40 receives a medal called the Field Medal. Now, of course, that's named after somebody named Field. It's got nothing to do with our use of the word field, but it shows you that even in the area of mathematics, their judgments, and sometimes they're wrong, they're less likely to be wrong, wrong meaning substantiated by the passage of time, than in painting, where there are lots of more whimsical and chimerical stars and disasters. Usually mathematicians are pretty much agreed about who's good by the age of 40. And then a few mathematicians are so brilliant that they refashion the domain. The domain was different after Hilbert or Gauss or Euler or Descartes, Euclid, other famous kinds of mathematicians. So again, what Csikszentmihalyi says, along with Feldman and me, is don't look just in the individual mind-brain, don't look just in the structure of the domain, the knowledge base, and don't look just in the field, the current powerful people, in the sense of the people who write the encyclopedias or the newspapers. It's only in the interaction between these that you have a real understanding of what creativity is all about. And I think that's a genuine conceptual advance in social science. Social science doesn't advance very much, and when somebody makes a conceptual advance, it's worth advancing a little jig. There are two primary approaches which students of big C creativity take. The nomothetic approach, which in our day has been taken chiefly by a very talented psychologist named Dean Keith Simonton, is looking at huge sets of data about creativity and trying to answer questions about creativity on the basis of quantification. And you can only do that with large data sets. So let's say you were interested in whether lawyers peak later than lyric poets. That would be a common hypothesis. What Simonton will do will to take a look at work done by lawyers in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and poetry done by poets in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and get some kind of objective measure like how often it's cited or anthologized. And indeed, he will probably find that lyric poets reach their heights in their 20s or 30s, whereas lawyers reach their heights in their 50s. That's a nomothetic, nomothetic meaning law, nomos is law or regularity, approach. The approach that I and my close colleagues, Feldman, Csikszentmihalyi, and Howard Gruber, have taken is called an ideographic approach. An ideographic approach, ideo meaning individual, unique, idiosyncratic, you study a few individuals in great depth and detail, and you hope, at least I hope, that as a result of these individual case studies, they eventually will sum up to reveal some more general patterns. So you might think of ideography over here is beginning with a few cases and slowly building up enough so that it can meet the nomothetic, which has these very large data sets. You might say, well, why not just look at the large data sets? And I think one answer is the large data sets don't give you any insight into mechanisms. You don't really know why the lyric poets are more published in their 20s and lawyers in their 50s. You can make a guess. But, for example, it might just be the case that writers like young poets because they're more glamorous. You'd never get that from the data. But if you do individual case studies, you might be able to find that kind of answer. But I'm not arguing for one approach for the other, just trying to introduce the difference. In books called Extraordinary Minds and Creating Minds, I have studied a number of outstanding creators, in particular the ones whom I showed earlier, the dozen or so people, and I now want to tell you some findings which actually cut across at least some of the creators, and sometimes some of the categories of creators that we talked about earlier, artists, scientists, political leaders, and moral exemplars. In creators, and here I'm not talking about leaders or political exemplars, but just the individuals whom I mentioned who were creative in different intelligences, that is Freud, Einstein, Picasso, Stravinsky, Martha Graham, T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, not Gandhi, not Mozart, not Margaret Thatcher. What you find is that these individuals grew up, by and large, in fairly comfortable bourgeois households. They were not living in abject poverty in some kind of a hovel. They had parental supports, typically intact families. But the support was often contingent upon their developing good work habits. These were fairly serious, sober households, not a lot of fooling around for their own sake. Despite the relatively supportive homes that these individuals had, by and large, they would move at a very early age, typically 18 to 20, to a metropolis, to a big city. Most of these people were in Europe, so they would move to London, Paris, Zurich. If they were in the United States, they'd move to New York or Hollywood. Hollywood is a metropolis from the point of view of entertainment, and it's located toward a genuine metropolis, of course, Los Angeles. And there, whether or not they were more extroverted or more solitary, they would look for other people, other young Turks, other young rebels. They would be kind of a sensing out of who are the other people in my world who are testing the limits. I almost think about it in an ethological way as looking for what we call a conspecific, a member of the same subspecies, somebody else who is a challenger. You have to master a domain, and as I will point out, one of the few accepted bits of wisdom in this field is it takes about 10 years to become a proficient painter or artist or writer or scientist or mathematician. You can't cut it very quickly. Einstein and Picasso and Mozart are interesting in this respect because they were prodigies. They started very young, so they had mastered the domain by the time they were teenagers, so they had a lot of time to do original work thereafter. But it takes a while to master a domain. Most people who master domains are satisfied at doing just that, and they become what we call experts. They are people who do what they do very well, but they have no particular inclination to be creative, and they typically aren't. They are the termen adults, people who are just the salt of the earth, the rock of the community, but they're never going to be doing stuff that's particularly remarkable in a domain. What distinguishes the creator is that when he or she finds something unusual, an anomaly, something which doesn't fit, a question which people haven't asked before, rather than sweeping it under the rug, which most of the rest of us would do because it complicates life, they pursue this. They try to understand it. They get deeper and deeper into it, and the more they get deeply into an anomaly, the more estranged they are from other people. Because everybody says, why are you spending all this time worrying about Brownian notion or traveling in a light beam, as Einstein did, or distorting contours the way Picasso and Braque did, or getting rid of tonality the way Schoenberg and Stravinsky did, or getting rid of regular verse the way the free verse people in the 19th and 20th century did. So they're weird. They're fascinated and they're weird. And this makes them increasingly isolated. They have a need for support, however. The fact that they're alone doesn't mean they can go it entirely alone. And almost everybody whom I studied had one or more breakdowns as they were doing their work alone. In a sense, the pressure was too great. They couldn't take it, because they're saying, am I nuts? Because I'm seeing this, understanding this. Well, I think I am, but nobody else does. And then, could I be nuts? That's a very frightening kind of thing. So they need to have support at that time, or they're likely to go over the deep end. And there's a perennial tension between disciplined thought, because they have mastered the domain or discipline. They do know how to do something, quote-unquote, the right way, and out-of-the-box thinking, because the domain and discipline isn't adequate to make sense of what it is that they're confronting now. I'm giving this lecture with an audience of two, and one of them is Shauna Moran, a graduate student, and she's studying commitment in individuals. And you wouldn't do this sort of thing unless you were very, very committed, because, in a sense, you're ignoring all the external signs, and you risk, to make a bad pun, of being committed in another way, because if you're crazy, and some of these people are pretty crazy, you might just go off the deep end. I brought this here because one question we might ask is, who are these people who are more likely to be iconoclastic, to want to be revolutionary or break down? And an interesting clue comes from Frank Soloway, who is a historian of science, who has made the interesting discovery that later-borns are much more likely to be rebellious than early, than first-borns. And the data he has are quite amazing. He looks at people who were early supporters of very revolutionary ideas, like communism or Darwinian evolutionary theory or Luther's form of Christianity. And he finds that almost all the early supporters were later-borns. And in the case of Darwin, it took a full century for firstborns to be as much supporters of Darwinian theory as laterborns. However, I have to say that even though I like Soloway's theory and it has the ring of truth, it doesn't particularly explain the biggest creator, who tends to be firstborns. Why is that? Well, that's probably for historical reasons. They got the more resources. Historically, it was very important to be the firstborn. But as far as support of iconoclasm, those are later-borns. The people whom I picked, as I intimated from my first study in the book Creating Minds, were picked because I thought they were outstanding in one or another intelligence, quote-unquote. And this slide indicates what I actually found, which was more complicated. Number one, they were mostly strong in more than one intelligence. Number two, often they were strong in intelligences which weren't quite typical for that brand of work. So like Einstein was a physicist who were very strong in logic and math, but Einstein had incredibly powerful spatial imagery as well, and that was very important for his work. Freud fashioned himself as a scientist, and I don't think that's an unfair characterization. Most scientists are strong in logical, mathematical, and spatial. Freud was actually rather weak in spatial, but he was very strong in language and personal intelligences, and his distinctive contribution in psychoanalysis plays upon that more than on the typical logic and spatial components of scientific thinking, and so on. While I didn't have any objective measures of weakness, biographies indicated that these people typically had areas of weakness as well. Picasso, for example, was a disastrous student in school. Stravinsky was the only person who didn't strike me as having unusual weaknesses, or any weaknesses, though he was a remarkably stingy and difficult person, but that doesn't count as a weakness. But I want to say a word about Freud, because Freud didn't like music, and his sister was a quite talented pianist, and Freud complained to his parents about his sister's practicing, and his parents got rid of the piano. That's a very important bit of information, because it will not have escaped your attention. Most people who I've studied are men and not women. And if you look until recent times, in any public sphere, art, science, politics, the overwhelming number of major creators are men. As Virginia Woolf, who was the first major essayist in English who was a woman, as she pointed out, if you want to be an artist, you have to have a room of your own and 300 guineas a year. That's probably like a few thousand dollars in contemporary money, maybe $10,000. And as exemplified by the Freud story, whatever resources were available until the 20th and 21st century tended to be given to men, not women, which is why we have many, many more male big C creators than women. We all hope that will change, but I think we can say it's going to change in some domains more quickly than others. many people had pointed out that it takes about 10 years to master a domain, but I made a discovery, quote unquote, that great creators tend to have breakthroughs about every 10 years. Now, this is obviously a very gross kind of characterization, but it isn't so gross that I couldn't create a slide with it on. And if you look in my book, Creating Minds, you can see supporting evidence for this. But make two points about this. One, there are certain domains, such as the arts, where it's easier to continue being creative in the area than it is in the sciences. Einstein's creativity after 20 years was no longer in the area of science, it was in philosophy. And I think lyric poetry, mathematics, and science, by the time people are age 40, typically their best work has been done. That's not at all true in the arts, where people can continue to do innovative work really as long as they are alive. The second point is sort of whimsical. I was once giving this lecture in front of a famous scientist, and he got up and he said, well, you know, I don't agree with what you said, because actually it only takes me 5 years to have my next breakthrough. And then I realized that this scientist works all the time with his spouse. I said, well, that's because you and your spouse work together, and each of you takes 5 years. The relationship between prodigiousness, very talented young kids, and adult creativity, adults who actually do something new rather than just being an expert, is a very interesting one, and not at all intuitive. Most of us, for better or for worse, are neither prodigies nor adult creators, and that's what makes the world go round. And we really don't want airplane pilots or surgeons to be too creative anyway. They just assume they do their job, or plumbers do it well. Most of the mathematicians, musicians who are prodigies, who are very good when they're very young, are not remarkable as adult creators. They just become adults more quickly, but they do ordinary routine kind of work. So that's the second line of the chart. Most of the masters of the modern era whom I studied and whom I've been mentioning repeatedly were not particularly prodigious. You know, they were, so to speak, bright kids, but they weren't doing something when they were young which caught everybody's attention. Indeed, by and large, even by the age of 20, you couldn't predict exactly what they would be doing, though you could predict the kind of areas in which they might be. Very rare is that Picasso or Mozart, who is an unambiguous prodigy as a child and then makes unambiguously creative breakthroughs as an adult. And here's why, according to my analysis. If you're a prodigy, your domain has been selected for you by your parents or God. And I don't mean that facetiously. You're so good at learning chess or math or music that you really have no choice but to go down that path. However, going down that path doesn't mean you're ever going to do anything innovative. You have to create a personality, I'm putting this metaphorically, which is rebellious, which is limit testing, which is willing to be knocked down and get up and try things again. And it's much easier just to do what the world wants you to do, so then you become an ordinary expert and not somebody who's particularly innovative. For non-prodigies, most creators being non-prodigies, they first develop a robust and somewhat limit-testing personality, one that's not afraid to take chances, to confront authority, to go off in his or her own way. So in a sense, they've got the personality of a creator, but then they have to select an area to which to be creative. Unless they're Leonardo, they can't be creative in everything. And they do select an area, but they don't select it randomly. Picasso could not have been a mathematician. Eliot could not have been a dancer. They select their domain from constrained options, and here's where my intelligence figures. They tend to pick those domains in which their intelligences are very strong. And when their intelligence is somewhat unusual for a domain, that may actually help them be creative, though it may make it more difficult for the field to appreciate what it is that they were doing. Watson and Crick's recognition of the double helix was very quick, because this was a problem that everybody was trying to solve. Well, everybody knew how to be solved, and the way in which they solved it, the other scientists in the domain could see, oh yes, that's right, that's what it is. And so they were recognized quite quickly. Einstein took much longer, because people were not asking the question Einstein was asking, and the form of his answers, and even more the way he thought about it, which is a much longer talk, was not the way that the kind of first principle thinking that he had was not the way that physicists around the turn of the century were working. Now I want to turn to, we might say, the more less happy side of creativity, the more pathographical side, pathography being a word of biographies which emphasize the negative. I thought that most of these people would just sort of do their own work and be discovered. That's not true. Almost all creators are quite heavily involved in promoting themselves because they realize at some level the field isn't going to come to them. In fact, the field is predisposed to recognize what's already being recognized rather than recognizing something new. And so they have to make efforts to bring attention to themselves. And people like Gandhi and Freud devoted enormous energy to bringing attention to their work. And even people like Einstein, who were sort of otherworldly, Einstein knew very well who was reading his work. He made sure it was sent to the right people. He pushed in certain jobs he wanted to have. And I realized recently in reading Einstein that he also had his father doing this. When Einstein didn't get a job, his father actually wrote to different people and said, would you hire my talented son? So you don't have to promote yourself if somebody else will do it. Darwin was lucky. He had Thomas Henry Huxley, who was called Darwin's bulldog, because Huxley went all around and promoted Darwin, and so Darwin didn't have to do it himself. But if you don't have a promoter, you better be able to promote yourself. The other thing, sort of sad to me, is these individuals' relationship to other people, particularly as they get older. Almost none of them is nice to other people unless those other people can help them do what they want to do. They're very, very opportunistic, and they range from Einstein, who didn't care much about other people, to Picasso, who was a frankly and rather nakedly sadistic individual. And most of the people are a little bit closer to sadism than they are to disregard. Now, we don't know whether at age 20 these people would have seemed different than others, whether they would have seemed any more selfish or sadistic than many other ambitious young people. But certainly by the time they get to be 50, 60, or 70, they're very, very difficult. Why is that? We don't know. But one possibility is that they can get away with it because everybody wants to be near them. They're very exciting. They're very charismatic, so they can be exploitative. Another possibility is that time is running out and they have all these projects. They want to finish them. That become the most important thing for them, and they just can't afford to have the nicenesses which we would hope people would have throughout their lives. Here's a somewhat whimsical rendering of this. This is an article about Albert Einstein, universally associated with genius and personal ability. But the gentle physicist was an adulterous, egomaniacal, misogynist, who may even have beaten his first wife, etc. And this is about deadly Dr. Freud, who was accused of family criminal acts, sudden disappearance of primal mother, identified with 20 murderers, made bizarre imitations of Satan and three satanic pacts, homicidal acts toward relatives, colleagues, patients. Now, I'm not saying we should take any of this seriously. There may be a scintilla of truth, but the point is that these are contemporary efforts to really accentuate the negative, so to speak, in individuals who are highly creative. A couple more findings from my biographical studies. I said earlier that people who are at the verge of breakthroughs are often at risk for breakdowns, and they need to have two kinds of support. Affective support means people love them and cherish them for whom they are. Cognitive support means people try to understand what they're doing and saying, you're not nuts, this makes sense, and so on. Everybody knows about Picasso and Braque. They provided both cognitive and affective support at the time when they were inventing Cubism. Freud had a very supporting and loving family to provide affective support, and a nut named Fliess, Wilhelm Fliess, who kept telling Freud that Freud's crazy ideas were okay, and Freud told Fliess, who believed everything was due to the nose, for Freud it was several feet down, provided intellectual support. Martha Graham had a lover named Louis Horst, who was also her arranger and who encouraged her to do innovative choreography. So that need for support is very, very important. And the kind of geniuses who go nuts, Wittgenstein comes to mind, are often ones who don't have that kind of support. And then finally, a bit dramatic, but you know about Dr. Faustus and the agreement where for him to be able to maintain his work, he enters into a pact with the devil. And his soul goes to the devil. He will eventually go wherever the devil goes, but he's given health, energy, inspiration for however long he's permitted to live on earth. And part of the Faustian bargain is if you're given this gift of inspiration, you will spend all your time on this work. I'm, in fact, in the middle of reading Dr. Faustus now, which is Thomas Mann's great 20th century novel. It's about Adrian Leverkuhn, who is a composer who has one sexual encounter with a prostitute where he gets some kind of a sexually transmitted disease, and then some years later he's visited by the devil, and he and the devil make an agreement that he can do the new kind of music, the new music of the 20th century, but in the end he will die in disaster. This is anticipated. I haven't got to the end of the novel yet, because he's syphilitic and because he's entered into this agreement with the devil. Now, I mention this because Thomas Mann, who was a genius and one of the great writers of the 20th century, not sufficiently appreciated in English, patterned this after Nietzsche, who did go nuts and die and was a genius, and Schoenberg, who was the great innovator in 12-tone music in the 20th century. An interesting bit of intellectual history: everybody knew that Mann was writing about Schoenberg, who lived 10 blocks away in Hollywood, because they were both emigres from Europe. But when he published the book, he didn't mention that. And Schoenberg, who was every bit as angry and sadistic as he, actually had a fit. And so in the later editions of the book, there's this wonderful thing, in both in German and English, which says it may not be supererogatory to mention. Supererogatory means it may not be unnecessary for me to say that I patterned this after Schoenberg, who actually invented 12-tone music. So this is when the titans begin to fight with one another, you have to duck. Five factors that characterize genius. Number one, geniuses, the kind of people whom I've studied, are amazingly childlike. They're willing to ask childlike questions. They're willing to be ridiculous and be ridiculed. Think of Einstein and Picasso or some of the photos we've seen. But at the same time, because they are, they're going to do great things, they often are very serious, even when young. So there's a kind of neoteny, some preservation of youthful characteristics even into adulthood. Second of all, passion and commitment. Willingness to spend years in a problem or project. Taking the long-term view. Kierkegaard said, in 100 years, everybody in Europe will be reading my journals. Beethoven said the same thing about his music. People like Gandhi and Monet said, you won't know for 100 years after I die how successful my project's been. Most of us don't think in quite those long terms. Like, I got a dentist appointment tomorrow, that's clouding my purview. And part of this passionate commitment about ideas or projects is they're willing to slough things off, including the pain of others. Woody Allen, by the way, and Picasso share an interesting character. They never go to funerals. It's interesting. This is a line from Einstein. Einstein never wore socks, said it was too much trouble, and he used to shave using the same soap as he did for washing his hands. And somebody said, why don't you use shaving cream? It's much less painful. He said, oh, two soaps, much too complicated. So this is often ignoring of things the rest of us might think about in order to be in our own intellectual world. An odd mind, an eccentric mind, particularly within one's chosen domain, an unusual blend of intelligence and weaknesses, quite distinct from the term and high IQ types, who are decidedly not odd, they're just a bit brighter than the rest of us. And very importantly, the kinds of people I study, these creative geniuses, have minds that are quite different from the generalist. The generalist is somebody like a lawyer or politician or a business person, we might say sort of a standard high IQ type who's good in language and logic, but who doesn't have a particular passion to which 5 or 10 or 20 years will be devoted so that something innovative can be done. Indeed, Derek Bach, who was the dean of the Harvard Law School and then the president of Harvard College, once come to me as an expert and said, I don't understand. He said, the students at the law school, the brightest students I know, but none of them have any passions or interests. They're so different from the cellists and the mathematicians at Harvard College. Now, I, of course, wouldn't agree with his claim that they were the brightest people that he knows, but what he meant is these kids are very, very smart at the law school and the kind of thing that lawyers have to do, but he and I agreed that law school is kind of the place you go if you have the mind of the generalist and you don't have a particular passion to solve a chemistry problem or write a great dance. great dancer, great dance, choreographer, great dance. Fourth point is enormous capacity for solitude. This doesn't mean these people aren't gregarious, they don't like other people. Some of them are, do, some of them don't. But they have much, much more capacity for being alone than most of the rest of us. This may be gender marked. Anthony Storr has a very interesting book called Solitude, with a famous painting. I think it's Eakins on the front cover of a solitary oarsman and a skull in a college river. But they can be alone even when they're in a social milieu. You know, you can think you're talking to them, and they can be a million miles away focusing on a problem. For the creators we've been talking about so far, the work they're doing, the objects with which they're involved, the projects that they're doing, they trump the human dimension. The other people just aren't as important as this consuming project. As I say, it doesn't preclude friendships or collegiality, though often they're quite targeted. Einstein had a group called the Olympiad, which he led. This was a group of four or five young people who lived in Zurich in the early part of the century. And they would get together and they would drink and have fun. Picasso had a similar group. But Einstein was using that in order to solve the problems he was thinking about. And as soon as he solved them, the group disbanded. Similarly with Picasso, who was with a bunch of young intellectuals and artists in Montmartre early in the century. Shaw and genius. Shaw said, George Bernard Shaw, that a genius is a person who finds the company of his own mind much more congenial than the company of other people. And Yeats, the Irish poet, said people must choose between perfection in the life and perfection in the work. Perfection in the life, I guess, would mean that you really want to have optimal relationships with everybody. You're the ultimate host. You're the ultimate convivial personality. You love to make other people feel good. You write thank you notes to people who send you thank you notes, etc. That's very different from the perfection in the work. You slough those things off. You don't answer your email because you've got something more important to do, namely to finish that project. Finally, this is a hard thing to prove, especially to skeptics, but I think it's worth saying, and it's a point that Csikszentmihalyi emphasizes a lot, is that, you know, these people might cheat on the income taxes, they might cheat on their wives or husbands, but they don't cheat on their work. There is an unerring sense of doing it rightly, doing it thoroughly, doing it honestly, doing it truthfully. Often to the point that when they talk to other people, they're chilling because they're so direct, they say exactly what they think. They don't make any amends for niceness at all. And they're kind of surprised when people react or overreact, but that's not polite society. You cloud things down. Even if you don't feel so good about something, you don't make people feel bad. But these people, they don't have that skill. Again, they can get rid of the clutter, you know, the email, and focus on the stuff that's really central. A nice phrase is their minds are uncluttered. And this can often slip into open defiance. I think of Noam Chomsky in this regard, who we both read about in the course and saw live a couple of weeks ago, and this is the year 2003 that I'm speaking. With Chomsky, you get the feeling if everybody says he's wrong, he probably figures he's on the right track. And that's not true of quite the same degree with everybody I've studied, but kind of they're so used to being right when other people are wrong that objections are taken as a sign of confirmation rather than the sign of, my God, I better do this over again because I must be all wrong. So this is a fifth thing which struck me and Csikszentmihalyi, even though it's very hard to show that A is more honest or truthful in his or her work than B. We've been talking entirely about what I call big C creators, individuals whose names will be in the encyclopedia. Somebody once asked Csikszentmihalyi, well, what are you? He said, I'm a middle C. And I guess what he meant playfully there was, you know, he'd like to be able to do something that's noticed, but he knows he's not going to be dominating the encyclopedias. I think most of us can aspire to is to be a middle C. And we shouldn't disregard little C, which are those small acts of creativity, the paper that's somewhat original, the poem which gets published in the local newspaper, the dinner party that everybody remembers because of how it was staged, the trip that was taken, the decision made. And I guess the big intellectual question is little C creativity part of the same continuum as big C or not? I think I would be inclined to take the minority view here and to say that big C creativity is qualitatively different. that, you know, be able to think in terms of 100 years is just not the same as being able to write a poem for the local newspapers. And that we're dealing with other kinds of dimensions when we deal with big C individuals. But I couldn't prove that, and it's really in a sense an analytic strategy, whether you want to emphasize the continuities between ordinary creativity. In ordinary creativity test, you're given a paperclip, and you said, how many uses can you come up with for a paperclip? And your score, that is how creative you are. I think that's a totally different kind of thing than, you know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. But some people would like to argue that the ends of a continuum, and this is not, this is like nature nurture. Neither side is going to be right or wrong. It's a question of which you get more mileage by emphasizing the differences between Beethoven's Ninth and a paperclip. Admittedly, I'm choosing a rather biased example, or stressing the similarities between these two. I want to go back now to some reflections about the four forms of extraordinariness, because I do think they are different subspecies. In the world of science, and here I'm thinking developmentally as well as in adults, you have an interest from a very early age in the world of objects, how they work, collecting things, putting them apart, putting them together again, modeling those objects and how they work, trying to come up with explanations which are as airtight as possible, and a focus, particularly in physics and math and in modern biology, of logical explanations, logical chains of reasoning, tests on experiments. And this calls really on logical, mathematical kind of intelligence. Artists, future artists, they're also interested in the world of objects, but probably more interested in the world of experience, how they're affected by various kinds of things. And this determines the messages they want to convey, because artists have things they want to express, ideas, feelings, insights they want to be able to share. But somebody once said to Auden, the great English poet, you know, I want so much to be a poet because I've got all these wonderful, great feelings of anxiety and conflict, and I'd love to be able to tell the world about it. And Auden cut him short. He said, you know, poems aren't made of feelings, they're made of words. And you have to master the medium. The fact that you have a new and original message to give is meaningless if you haven't mastered the meaning of words or the medium of tones or the medium of dance steps or the medium of sculptural clay or whatever material you're working with. And the mastery of the medium grows out of exploration of that medium, out of praxis over many, many years. I don't think any intelligences are particularly artistic or non-artistic, even musical. It's rather a question of how the intelligence is used. I'm using linguistic intelligence now in speaking, presumably, but I'm not using it all in an artistic way. But if I was very concerned about how my lecture was structured, if I was paying attention to the content of every sentence in terms of its scanning, its alliteration, its assonance, its metaphors, and so on, that would then be using linguistic intelligence artistically. Similarly, spatial intelligence can be used to play chess, or to navigate, or to sculpt. It's the same intelligence, but it's being used in a very different kind of way. And even musical intelligence can be used in the military to wake you up in the morning or get you to line up in a certain way. It can be used in the dentist to, use it in the dentist to lessen the pain. That's not using musical intelligence in an aesthetic way. Political leaders are characterized, first of all, by tremendous energy. Clinton, when he was 20, read that some person he admired, say Napoleon, only slept for 3 or 4 hours a night. So from then on, Clinton said, I'm only going to sleep for 3 or 4 hours a night. And in fact, that's what he did after that. I think many of us could have that resolution without being able to achieve it. Tremendous amount of energy. Not the jagged profile of intelligence that we expect for the scientist or the artist, but a rather flat profile, particularly in language, logic, and personal, which would be quite equal. Skill of storytelling, because an important thing that leaders do is to tell us stories. They, nowadays, they have people who help them make up those stories, but the best stories are ones which grow out of the person's own life. They're what we call embodied stories. And, of course, tremendous will. Will being somewhat different than commitment. I would say commitment is willingness to work on the same thing for long periods of time without knowing whether it's ever going to be completed or not. Will is more the drive to get something accomplished no matter what, with a particular means, probably less important than getting the end. And then moral exemplars of the type I studied, like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. and Jean Monnet, are people who are political fundamentally. They're interested in bringing about change in the wider world, but they have a long-term vision, one which in this particular case has an ethical dimension. And they can operate publicly the way Gandhi did, or behind the scenes the way Jean Monnet did. Now you might say, well, Hitler and Stalin had long-term visions too. Are they moral exemplars? Well, not on the definition of morality I would use, because morality involves having a publicly stated set of principles and codes which connect to one another, which you are willing to live your life by publicly, and where even when those things work against you, you're willing to live in accordance with them. And the biggest thing about people like Stalin or Hitler is they operate in secrecy, because of course what they say publicly has no relationship to what they're doing privately. So they are first-class hypocrites. Gandhi was completely transparent, even to the not wearing clothing. Everybody saw exactly what he was doing. Indeed, Himmler, who was Hitler's henchman, said of the Holocaust in 1943, "This is the greatest event in the history of the world which no one can ever know about." That is the definition of immorality, is if you're hiding what you're actually doing. Three lessons we can take away from extraordinary creators. I call this reflecting, leveraging, and framing. And these are things which I learned from spending a lot of time studying these people, which are things which I think all of us can apply to our lives, whether we are aspiring to be creators at all. The first thing is reflecting. Spending a lot of time thinking about what you're trying to do, and if it's not working out, trying to figure out how you might go about doing it differently, being able to step back and having distance from yourself. Second of all, leveraging, figuring out what you're good at, what your competitive advantage is, and really pushing that, and not worrying about the things you're not good at. You can have other people help you do things you're not good at if you help them with things that you're good at, but crying over spilled milk and saying, well, I'm not good at this and so I can't succeed, is a disaster. And third, and I think the most interesting, is what's called framing. Framing means taking positive lessons from things that don't go well. Everybody has things which don't work out. Everybody writes works and comes up with theories and makes political moves which are disastrous. The worst thing is if you let that disaster either defeat you so you quit, or you sweep it under the rug and ignore it, or you blame somebody else. Framing means saying, this didn't work out, what can I learn from it so next time I can do it better? And I'm struck over and over again by the brilliance of framing of the people whom I've studied to take an apparent defeat. Jean Monnet said, I regard every defeat as a challenge and an opportunity. And that's a very healthy form of framing. And all of us, whatever our aspirations, can learn from this constant reflection, this leveraging our own strengths, and this ability to learn from things that don't go well. Finally, I want to mention the work in which I'm involved now with my colleagues, Bill Damon and Mike Csikszentmihalyi, and that's linking creativity and leadership to responsibility. Responsibility means thinking about the implications of your work for the wider world and tempering your work to some extent in terms of how it can affect the world beyond the domain in which you're working. The question we're asking is whether you can be creative, innovative, a leader, and humane, that is, being concerned about human nature and the human condition at the same time. What we've done is to take our own work, Damon Csikszentmihalyi and I, on intelligence, creativity, and leadership, which until now we've studied in an amoral way. That doesn't mean immoral, but we've studied leadership, whether we liked Stalin or not. We studied him because he was an example of a leader. And to see whether we could introduce moral considerations, a sense of responsibility, and see individuals who manage somehow to combine these capacities of intellect or creativity or leadership to a sense of responsibility. This is clearly an ability at a premium in the age of Enron, where we see the perversion of creativity and intelligence for self-aggrandizing and socially destructive ends. And our first published work on that is called Good Work, When Excellence and Ethics Meet. It's a particular study of creativity and humaneness, or of achievement and responsibility in two domains, genetics and journalism. But the study in which we're involved now eventually will encompass 12 different domains of society. and will help us to answer the question, what does it take to be a good worker, somebody who is both an expert in what he or she does excellent work, but at the same time does it in an ethical way. So, to summarize, there are various kinds of extraordinariness, not just one. And I talked about creativity, intelligence, leadership, morality, prodigiousness, intelligence. While we have a definition of who is creative, the more sophisticated question is, where is creativity? And it's an interaction between individuals with their talents, domains and disciplines which instruct them and which they master, and fields which judge who's worth paying attention to, who gets to have some time in the sun, and a few of those individuals are actually creative enough that they change the domain. I then looked at some of the patterns in early childhood, in their work, that we find across creators, things which seem to require apply to creators' independent domains, and then some of the differentiae among people who are scientists and scholars, people who are artists, people who are working in the political realm, and people who are working in the ethical realm, which is closer to our example of good work. These people are extraordinary, but I think there are things the rest of us can learn, in particular reflection, leveraging, and framing. And the work that I'm doing now with other people, including Shauna Moran, is what are the developmental antecedents of these various forms of excellence? Can we say something about the developmental trajectory of people who end up being extraordinary in these various spheres, including the sphere of good work? And that's it.